at our meetings in our own village that they were concerned about what can they do for their lands. It's sort of an education to me because I was aware and I was concerned as same as they were. And I was real happy to get a chance to sit in on a first meeting that most of the villages had in the interior in 1962 in Tanana. At that meeting, we pointed out the concern for the wide areas that our grandfathers used for hunting and fishing and subsistence survival. We went into wide discussion on those areas. For some reason or another, our forefathers were kind of looking in the future and looking to what they might expect in the future and long-time goals. I think that's what their interest was in the land situation at that time. Anyway, during the meeting in Tanana, we outlined the areas that was badly needed in our communities, in our villages, with the housing, water and sewer, clinics, community halls, law enforcement, and some ways to get our village in a better position to live in. And those problems that we identified back in 62, 20 years later, has finally came into reality because a lot of villages has those services. Because of the grants we get from the state and from the federal through BIA. Then ANSCA came. Although there was just a handful of people participating in developing the ANSCA issue, I was sorry I didn't participate fully because I was engaged in my own living and trying to work for a living at one of the federal military base here in town. And as I look at ANSCA today, it created some good and some bad. I think the most important problem, which was never addressed in the first place. All along through my life, I've seen the changes in the big changes from generation to generation. The only problem that would solve our problem today is that if we had the opportunity for education from beginning when I was just a school kid. If I had my life to live over, the first thing I do is try to get my education and degrees. We are faced today through ANSCA without no sort of training and not knowing what we were getting into, and it's beginning to show up today because I know and I work for our village corporation. The problems that were supposed to be identified were not identified until somebody like me had to go through it. The number one issue that was supposed to be included.
My grandkids, that's not her home. You know, her home is is not there. That's white people's fault. They don't have the kind of food that she's 84 years old. She didn't grow up eating that kind of food, and having people come in there and bother her stuff, make her bed, wash her clothes. Up until November of this year, you know, she's still baking bread for my grandpa. And my grandpa wouldn't eat anyone else's cooking but hers. He insisted that she bake bread. He didn't want to have anyone else bake bread. And they don't care for food over there. They don't care for, you know, just sitting there all day waiting for family to come visit. And then to come home, my grandma said she got married when she was 16 and 19. And ever since they were married, my grandpa's always provided a place for her to stay. And to her, this is not something that he provides for her. It's not her home. She doesn't want to be there. I told her I would bring some things in the house, some of her pictures and stuff to put up on the wall. And she said, no, this isn't my home. I don't want anything in here. And right now, because of different complications in the family, they end up having to move out of their home. Their home is being sold. This was not last a native allotment land or anything like that. It was what they had purchased themselves. But they don't have any place to go. They don't have, I don't even know if they had applied for their allotment. And so I don't know. If I talk to them, sometimes they don't understand what you're talking about anyway. And my grandma says, I asked her to come here and talk and testify. And she says, no, I don't want to make waves. You know, what they've done, I can't say anything about it because Judy don't even have time, and I don't want to have anything to do with them. Just like when at the nursing home now, she has to have eye drops put in her eyes, and they have a specific time that they do that. Sometimes the nurses come right away, and if I'm there, I'll call the nurse. No, don't call the nurse. If she don't come, that's okay, don't worry about it. She doesn't want to bother anybody. And she said the other day, she was saying that she's never told anybody what to do. So as long as she's been married to my grandpa, she's never brought him around and told him what to do. And my uncle had married a non-native woman, and the problem that came up in the family was then having to live by the house and whatnot. She was blaming it on my uncle listened to her. She was helping him, but she was not him. That's not how they made it so different. I'm also concerned about the children, especially the ones that were born after 1971. I have two girls, and one was born in 69, and one was born in 81. One daughter is considered native and eligible for the land claims, and the other one is not. And I don't like that. To me, it's almost like discriminating against the own people. They're still, to me, they're both my children and they're both natives, and it's very difficult for me to think that they're being treated differently. As far as preserving our heritage and culture, I really believe that the people themselves are going to have to take it upon themselves to do that. Like with how Howard Luke was talking about the passage that he's giving at the university, teaching the younger generation about subsistence, how to build traps and live off the land the way he was raised to do. The way I was actually raised being white. I was raised in Delta. There were no other natives in the community. I thought of myself as being white. When I went up to the University of Alaska in 68, the students, native students in the villages, would call me Jessa, they, to them I was white, and I was not Native. And I talked with one woman here today who came to university. Really, it brought out in my mind that it was not only their feeling, but it was also my feeling that I was white. And I guess I portrayed that to them. You know, I felt the same way. And I feel like I really lost out on my culture and my heritage. And up until just recently, I've never really wanted to really understand what it was to live in a village and to be raised the way the natives have been. And I would like to do that, and I would like my children to do that. My oldest daughter stayed in Mitchell with a missionary family up there who was correspondent for 3 years. And she absolutely loved it. She said, "Mom, let's move to the village. You can do it." And I would like to see where we could live subsistence. You know, my husband being non-native and me being not the head of the house, being the native, I don't know how that would work out, being able to live subsistence lifestyle. I know when all these kids were born here in Fairbanks, if you were a Native man married to a non-Native woman, and you had medical care taken care of for your children, but if you were a non-Native man with a Native wife, then he had to pay for medical care. And my dad had to pay it when we were born in the hospital, had to pay to get us out of the hospital. They still talk about some don't have much money to get my sister out of the hospital. And she was just a baby. They had to come up with $300 or something before they could take her home. Well, if it was a Native man, they wouldn't have had that problem. Now my mother can go to the Native clinic. At that time, I was a Native clinic. But now she can go and all the kids can go. One thing that was brought up the other day that really struck me was how the Native treat the usage of living off the land. They use everything. They shoot and move things, every single piece of that. Even the head, they'll boil it up into the soup. I mean, they don't waste anything at all. And yesterday, after the meeting, my husband and I had gone out and had a pizza, and we walked into the back room, and here on the table was more than half a pizza, just, you know, just wasteful. And the natives don't do that with it. When they take a meat, if it's for their own use, or for a potlatch, or for, you know, anything, they use every bit of it. They're not wasteful anymore. Talking about living off the land and being able to provide for your family from the land. I know my husband is not Native, but he's a very good hunter. As long as he's been up in Alaska, he's never eaten any kind of meat from the store. He's hunted and gathered meat. And if there is anyone that he knows that needs meat, he's willing to share, you know, that game with them. And I would like to see the natives who are living subsistence lifestyle not be so controlled that they can have, we have to have at least two native one, you know, one person can get one meat. Like some of the older people who cannot go out hunting anymore. Someone needs to take care of them, and I don't think it should be the government. That's not the way they lived long ago. The people who take care of their own people. And My husband has gone out in the last couple of years and taken my daughter with him to visit with two moves. And our family can to move to one year, but we did it all the way. We did it to people who cannot come. And I would like to, you know, years ago, and I had to read this stuff at university in one day, but when I was making a report for one of my classes one time, in villages where they would have what you would consider almost famine, and they'd have sometimes one man who was a really good hunter, and it was almost his responsibility to feed the whole village. And he would, you know, they didn't have all the sophisticated kind of rifles and whatnot like they did when the Americans came here. To be able to go out hunting, they had to do it. I mean, they would just bow and arrow or harpoon or whatever. They had to go out and get the big game that way. And sometimes when the hunting was scarce, it would take a real good hunter to be able to get anything. And he would survive the whole village. And now, say, if you know, you have a village with a bunch of people there, and only a few people are going out hunting, and yet everyone needs to eat, I don't think they should do it. You know, one move to one person. I would like to see, as far as education, for the native, I'd like to see more things that are going on, like with how we being able to teach classes where the younger generation and people like me who do not have the opportunity to live, to be able to learn how to do that. I'd like to see more than just, you know, one person, if they could use the elders as a resource for teaching the younger kids how to do different things. I remember when I was young, I don't know how old I was, 10 years old or something, my great uncle came to visit us for about a year. He was 96 years old. And he asked my mother, "What would you like me to make for you?" And she said, "I'd like a doctor." And he went outside and chopped some trees down and took them back. And I don't know, he didn't use any kind of electrical tools or anything. He didn't even use an electric drill. He showed me how he made it with a stick with a nail on the end of it and a little bowl, and he put it in his mouth and he moved that bowl and it would drill a hole. He made everything that he worked on that thread with. He made anything that he used from nothing. I mean, he could go out 96 years old, he could go out and work and he could make whatever he wanted to. He didn't have to go to the store and buy anything. And that sled day is really, there's so many people trying to buy it off my mother. People down in Delta, non-natives, have tried to copy that sled time and time again, and they can't do it. They have the sled right there. They look at it, they can see what's holding it together, and they can't make a sled like that. I don't know, you can't pass it on just by looking at it. You know, you have to learn how to do that. And I would like to see some of these older people, their knowledge and the way that they grew up passed on to the younger generation. I know with my grandma and grandpa, they have been exploited in a way by non-natives for many years. They did Eskimo dancing for Alaska Airlines all over the world, in Japan, Paris, and Canada, and Australia, and New York City, and Seattle, and all over. They did Eskimo dancing, and at one time, some company made a record of their songs that they used and acknowledged them on the record with their names, that they were singing the songs. and sold the records and made money on it with no rights to my grandparents. And my grandpa really feels like he was really exploited in that area, and some of the things that he could teach us and pass on to us, some of the old stories and the history, and you know, the songs, stuff. He won't do it. He won't do it in his family. We wanted to record some of the stories, things that happened in his life, and just the family, with my mom and dad and the kids that were there, we take good photos to them all. I'll promise to you, if you turn the paper to it. And I really feel like we're being, you know, cheated in a way. We're losing some of that heritage that we could have been. I think that not only education for the Native people, going back to the culture and the heritage and learning about that, I know some of the, well, all the people that come from the villages, a lot of people have them already, but people that don't have that, or in younger generations, a lot of them don't even care or want to be identified. Like my oldest daughter now, she would love to live in the village, or move to the village and build a house there. But when you really talk about it, she doesn't want to be identified as being a Native, because she, you know, she doesn't consider herself a Native. Although she's 3/4 as the one, and I'm only half. You know, it's the way I imagine I brought her up, because the way I was growing up, it's almost instilled in me. But not only should we learn the Native traditions and culture, but also like the language. Here one lady was talking about teaching bilingual language in school, and even in the village now, they learn their native tongue as a second language, where English is first. And when they first had school, whether it was, well, not in the village to begin with, but like in non-income or something where my mother went, their native language is what they learned to speak at home, and they learned the second language, English. And now they've got that turned around. I know my native language, in order for me to speak it, somebody also has to teach me at school. My grandma tried to teach me a few words here and there, and she but not only should we learn that type of thing, but also if we're to get along in the world today, be able to understand the system that has been set up by federal government, we're going to have to get another kind of education. College where not only can we understand what it is to live in the village, but we're going to be dealing with the corporate structure that's already set up and expected to live in that. We're going to have an education that will enable us to get along in that area. Just like up until now, I'm just beginning to understand a little bit about what Alaska Native land claims is about. I'd like to understand more how the federal government has dealt with the Indians and in the states, and then look at how they're dealing with the natives in Alaska. And one fellow had talked about that at our corporation meeting, and I talked to him afterwards, and he said, well, we need to understand thoroughly Title 25 of the U.S. Code, and that deals with all the Indians. And I read and understand Title 43, which has to do with the land. And so I went down to the library and got those titles out, and it was like Greek to me. With little pieces of paragraphs here and there and try to put it all together. I don't understand how to do that. I'd like to go to school and understand how to read law and how to look it up and how to, you know, how they write it and that type of thing.
Well, I'm glad we convened our meeting tonight, even though we realize how many of it might be coming. It's most spoke during the day on Wednesday and Thursday again today. If anyone else would like to speak tonight, I'd like to hear you. We'll be convening again tomorrow at 10 o'clock for the last time. We'll just have a meeting here tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock, and that'll be our last meeting. But if anyone else would like to speak tonight,
we're going to Manana on Sunday, and then we'll come across Monday. Yes, sir. Hello. Yes, please do. My name is Larry Peterson from Fort Utah, and I'm just curious. I know that the Native people or the Indian people in the United States have been one of the most studied group in the whole world. And now I see another study going on here. Now, with all the information I've seen in the files, I'd like to know what's going to be done with it. Is there anything positive that come out of it? Or is it that just people come up here and just tell all the problems?
Well, that's a good question. This really isn't a study. The Inuit Circumpolar Conference, which is an international organization based in Alaska and Canada and Greenland, asked me to come and to go around the state and hear the views that Alaska Natives wanted to express in each region about land development and land settlement. The World Council of Indigenous People, which is an international organization of Indians, is also sponsoring this organization. But it isn't just studying Native people, it's the Native people that free them to express their views on these things. I'm going to compile a report that will be available to the public next year, and it will be for the purpose of enabling Alaska Natives to decide for themselves what direction they want to go in the future. The Native organizations that actually do this had in mind that it's an opportunity for Alaska Natives to speak, not simply to have somebody come and look at them and get
lost. I was just curious because I wasn't quite sure exactly what the whole aspect of the thing would come out to be. I'll give you a little background about the experience I have had. First of all, I stated I was born and raised in Fort Utah. And I did go to school at Mount Edgecombe. I was a city council member that interacted with the politics of the town. And I went on and became president of the Native Association up there, which was an IRA council at that time. And the land plan started up. and became very active from that. And also been vice president and chief about 3 times. Then from there I went on and became state representative. And then working for Natives all my life. And I had a lot of mixed feelings exactly, you know, what I really am in a way, which I am a Native. But I've been labeled by other people as, oh, you're not Native, or yeah, you are Native, or, you know, you're in between. Because I've went through this type of experience. And I've lived most of my life in the villages, but I also can exist in the urban areas, which is hard for a lot of the people that I work with, you know, that try to come into the urban areas in which to hold a job and work and do other things. So I'm caught kind of in between. And it kind of bothers me, like, in a way, like I've had a lot of people come down and downgrade, like, my head is covered, and all these sending students a long distance away. I disagree with sending, you know, children, like in grade school, you know, to long distance. But I think for high school students, I think it's an opportunity in which they can get and start looking at other things other than just one small community, which to me, like, I grew up out of. Feelings about that too. I think that if an individual has stock, he has the right in which to sell what he wants to sell. And I don't think that the regional corporation should dictate and tell somebody whether they could sell or not sell. And whether we want to face the facts or not, some of the corporations are going to belly up. And if they can't sell their stock, then what is the land comes forth? I mean, the individual that has stock that's worthless, they can't do nothing with it. In sitting and listening to quite a few different meetings and different other gatherings and so forth, I kind of get totally confused exactly what our roles are. There are people said that the land claim as far as corporation goes, not the route to go. That individual people should get the land, which I think is great and fine. Except if you don't have some type of way of bringing in money, in which eventually that the state and federal is going to start taxing that land, and you don't have some way of bringing in money, and if you do distribute it all out, then they're going to lose it. Now, where the media is going to be, I don't know exactly what the solution is going to be. And there are a lot of problems. There are a lot of problems within the villages with alcohol, with drugs, those things have to be looked at. And there are a lot of federal and state funding that goes into these programs. And you don't see the positive actions that come out of any of this stuff. Also, that as I sit and listen, and most times I don't do very much talking because I'm a very good listener, and I sit back and see and start thinking about some of these problems that is happening, and it's happening very fast. When the land claim was passed, a lot of people in the villages didn't even know what a corporation was. And a lot of them still don't know what a corporation is. And a lot of them don't know all the terminology of what a stockholder is, what a proxy vote holder is, and many other things that go along with a corporation. And when the land claim was passed, we ran into a lot of problems as far as we're not like a corporation like IP&T. Or the big corporations, AT&T and so forth, that every individual there owns an equal share of stock. For these larger corporations, people do have control of the majority of the stock, which we don't have here in our corporation, but the state law had to be amended to work within the corporate law. And that was kind of a hassle, which did pass through the state legislature, but it didn't pass. And as far as seeing what's in the future and seeing, you know, whether the land plan is the best solution or not, it probably wasn't, but it was a start in which to deal with some of the things. And if anybody has ever studied and looked through the land plans and start saying, you know, what we were going to get, and it turned out a lot more, because the several governments that we had wanted to give 12 million acres of land, and we ended up with 40 million acres of land. But that's due to a lot of other things, whether we want to admit it or not. A lot of it is geared to the outcome itself at the time and the energy crisis. Because when the oil fields were, they said, discovered up in Kuba Bay, at the time they said it was, because they knew about it back in 1902, they called it their Navy Petroleum Reserve. By the time they were feasible, expense-wise to get it out, it would cost too much money. And as the fuel shortage became greater and greater and greater, and then we pushed it to get it, and at the time, also my time to get it pushed. And it went hand in hand. I'd say fairly well. Probably wasn't the best deal, but it was better than mine. And as time goes on, and I start seeing things that have happened, a lot of the village corporations started businesses, and learning under the state and different other things, some of them lost the businesses. And it might have been better if they just stuck the money into the trust fund and just brought interest. And for a while, their interest rate was pretty good. They're about 18%. But as time changes, some of the different things happen. And I see the problems that are going on, but I don't really see what you call a true solution, because each village is different, but the basic needs are the same. And we have a really kind of a unique situation where we have a lot of villages that are very remote, with not very many people. And we have a large city in the state that has practically about half the population. And then when we deal with government, especially the state government, as far as the needs in the villages, I say we're getting, you know, short-handed. But then again, you can turn the thing around and say, well, if half the population is in a larger urban area, then they should get more funding. So it's a kind of a two-way street here where you can see one thing and say, well, this is not right. And you look at another one and say, it is right. So what is right? That I can't answer, but it bothers me. But being raised in a small village, I can see a lot of the problems that are there. I can see a lot of fears and concerns, because all of a sudden, with the land plan, when you start looking at the news media, which isn't best or the greatest friend of a lot of people comes out and saves a great huge amount of money. And where's all this money going? What is happening to it? And we haven't even addressed the land, because some of the village hasn't even gotten their land yet, title to it. And we're over halfway through the land plan settlement act. And they don't have title to their land yet. Then we start thinking about, well, what's going to happen when all of a sudden the state is running out of oil revenues, and they're looking at the native corporations and their land base as a tax base. And there's already been legislation that has been trying to push through the state legislature in which to do this. Unfortunately, it did fail, but it's still there. And I wouldn't be surprised if that does pass in the near future, when the corporations themselves are still trying to get stand on their own 2 feet. There are so many things that I can't foresee yet. These are just some of the basic problems that we're looking at. There are more stumbling blocks that we're going to run into further down the line that we haven't even addressed yet. And some of the major things we're looking at now is how to protect that land. Now, what if somebody crashes on that land? Are we liable for suit? Which I think we are by law. What if some sort of fire there? Are we the ones that have to pay to put that out? And what if it goes out of our area into state or federal land? And are we liable for paying for that? These are some of the issues that bothers me and scares me. But they haven't been really addressed. And each time we have meetings and different other things, I see a lot of things that are going on that kind of disturbs me in a way that are being overlooked and not being addressed. And I guess some of you are saying, well, why don't you say something about it? I do talk to leaders, not like in a meeting, you know, get up and say things, but I do kind of drop the hint, say, hey, you know, what's going to happen when this comes about? They really don't have any answers. These are some things, you know, that are still down the line, but they're coming up awfully fast. And there are so many things that are happening, and our leaders are being stripped so thin right now that they can't cover all these things. And if they have to attend all these meetings that are being held, good God, how much money is it going to cost to go to these things? The expenses are great, but they're also important. These are some of the things that have bothered me, that I've lost some sleep about, staying up at night thinking about it, seeing if I can come up with some kind of solution. But I haven't really come up with any solution. I see a lot of the problems. And I think that's just about all that I really have right now, which is to say that I didn't appreciate the young lady here that stated as far as such as the funding goal that everything is utilized and used. And when she went to the piece of the work and policy was being wasted. And though these people are very conservative, they are they may not be the jack of all trades. You know, they are not master of all trades. However that's worthy. Because in a village, you're in a different situation. You can't call a carpenter and say, hey, come fix my house. They'll fix it themselves. The road breaks down, they fix it themselves. Or anything that happens within a village, they do themselves. They work on it, they fix it, and it's another thing. When the people turn around and start saying, people in the village, you know, are not educated, that's not true. I like statesmen and so forth that make all these decisions come out there and try to live and see if they can survive, see what their education can do for them out there. Instead of sit there with their $250 suit on and make decisions that they don't even know nothing about. Thank you very much.
Before you go, I want to thank you for that thoughtful presentation. You mentioned one thing that you said that the Wiggum rule of the state legislature to have a state property tax on the land of the state roads. Did you hear that?
Yes.
The person that started that was the Fairbank legislature by the name of Charlie Clark. In fact, they had hearings in Fort Yukon.
What the year was it?
Well, I didn't think we would have many customers this evening, but it's attended a very interesting I want to thank all of you who came and all of you who spoke, especially glad that Mr. Cruikshank spoke. I heard him speak at the elders lunch today and let him know to tell us something of the history of Alaska, with that in mind. Yes, sir.
I maybe say a few things now, but I've got more on the chat meeting in the town. That's where I'm from. I'm George Chester. And first off, I no way like the corporation says we have that their tax pool here. I mean, as in the land claims and the here's the sounds, let's say, people who are able to big game guys, and she can appear behind me, and just make a decision in my life. Of course, you got it there. So, and that's it.
Well, we've had a wide variety of views these last few days, and I sure appreciate it. I think that we'll adjourn until we speak until tomorrow morning at 10, and we'll have our final session, and then we'll meet at 9 o'clock Sunday afternoon, and then 10 o'clock in the morning.
I want to make a few brief comments. I'm an attorney with Alaska Legal Services, and I'd like to express the problem the clients have brought to us, especially the elderly and the disabled who are fixed on their income. I don't know if this problem has been brought up before.
Yes, yes, yes.
My name is Judy Bush. And our clients are in the situation sometimes of receiving dividends from their corporation, and when they do that, then their benefits from the government are cut back. So they are in the situation of receiving what they're really in the government and leaving within a few months from their old parents and their social security program and having the money deducted from their checks. Some of these older people have asked why can't they transfer their stock to their grandchildren who don't have any debt because they're not benefiting from it, and they have to do that in the problem.
Thank you very much. Native people here in Alaska, and